We return to Daniel chapter 3 as we've been walking through the great book of Daniel, and just time and time again, we continue to be reminded of the great lessons of the power of God and how we should respond in light of His awesome majesty and His glory and His greatness. And it's so great as we come to this book because it is a lesson so simple that even a kid can understand. And my daughter loves this story. It's probably one of her favorite stories. She loves telling about how King Nebuchadnezzar said, "Bow down to my statue." You know, she knows that part. She knows that, you know, we're supposed to not bow down to anyone except for to worship God. She knows these truths. They're so simple, and yet they're so relevant for us today because it's so often that we compromise. It's so often that we don't stand up for our faith and stand up for our God and proclaim His greatness, even as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were called to. And so we're reminded again this morning of the importance of having a big view of the greatness of God, understanding how powerful He is, and then how we should live in light of that. So let's just dive in quickly to this story and remind ourselves of some of these key truths, because I trust you'll find that they are very relevant for our lives as well. As we've been seeing, as we've been walking through Daniel, we've been introduced to this king, Nebuchadnezzar. And as we've continued to walk through here, I think you're starting to see that Nebuchadnezzar had an ego. He was the greatest king on the earth at the time. We saw that even last week, he was the head of gold. And so it went to his head. He knew that he was the greatest king. He had absolute power in that kingdom. What he said happened. He didn't need to pass any laws. He didn't need to get approval from anyone. He said it and it happened. He was the head of gold, the greatest king, the most powerful king in one sense that ever lived. And so as he has kind of took, you have to get the picture here, that King Nebuchadnezzar is expanding his kingdom. He's conquering other nations. He's taking them over. And once again, each of these nations, they had their own forms of religion. They had their own government. They had their own gods. But he's trying to take them over and assimilate them into one unified kingdom, into Babylon, you know, unified under his headship as the king. And so in his kind of grandeur and his taking over the world, as it were, he has this idea. He's going to build this magnificent statue and set up this huge ceremony, this dedication of this image, where he bring in all the officials from all his kingdom, thousands upon thousands, the high officials that were closest to him, even down to the lowest governors. He's going to bring in all the people ruling his land and have this ceremony of bowing down to his God, to his statue, kind of to unify them together in their religion, they kind of assimilate them into Babylonian worship and under his kind of reign and rule. It kind of reminds me, in a sense, of the kind of pomp and circumstance that, you know, communist Russia, you know, it's flexing the big arm. It's kind of, as you conquer the nations around you, it's, you are great, and there's kind of this intimidation. You got to unify with us. It's like, we are great. It kind of reminds me of that kind of an image. And he certainly was a great king, and he's kind of flexing his arm. He's showing his greatness. You can imagine all the soldiers kind of like lined up in the square, and the pomp and the circumstance and the orchestra and all these people. You'll notice, I think you were even kind of alluding to it, Bob, it's funny all the repetition with, you know, as he lists all the different people, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials, and repeat that over and over. And the point being, like, this is all the officials from the high to the low. And then it repeats all the instruments over and over, the flute, the trigon, the bagpipe. It's like, this is a big ceremony. This is a big ordeal. There's lots of pomp and circumstance, and Nebuchadnezzar has orchestrated this whole thing so that everyone bows down at the right time. It's like, do-do-do, everyone bows down. It's like, ah, my grandeur, my glory, my kingdom, everyone united together under my rule. So you could just kind of see his vision for uniting everyone together. And so they get all these rulers together. They set up this image. They get the orchestra. The orchestra plays. And I love verse 7. Because therefore, at that time, everybody heard and everybody bowed down. And it's just like everything went according to plan. You just kind of can picture it. Thousands upon thousands of people on their knees before this orchestra, before this image, and Nebuchadnezzar just kind of basking in his glory. But, right, verse 8 comes in. But there's a problem here. Everybody bowed down, but not everybody bowed down. There was three people among the thousands. Who knows how many people there were? Thousands. You could just imagine what it would look like. It's just everyone on their knees and three people are just standing alone amongst everyone. The king probably didn't even notice them. There were so many people, but people around them did. People around them, these Chaldeans, came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. See, this is probably getting a little bit racial at this point. Because, as we'll see, they come up before the king, they maliciously accuse the Jews, and then verse 9 says, they declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have made this decree that everyone should fall down." And verse 11, "Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the fiery furnace." Verse 12, "There are certain Jews," you can almost hear it in their voices, "whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon." So you remember back when the stories in chapters 1 and 2 had happened, they were raised in the kingdom because of, you know, where does it even say that then? At the end of chapter 2, I think, right? That Daniel was able to, in chapter 2, verse 49, Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So because of what happened in chapter 2, where Daniel interpreted the dreams, he was able to give his friends high-ranking positions within the nation of Babylon. And so there's got to be some jealousy going on here, that these Jews, these foreigners, they're in a high-ranking position. And yet we're the Chaldeans, we're the nationals, we're kind of like the national Babylons, we're underneath these Jews. So there's some racism probably going on there, there's some jealousy going on there. There's also probably a degree of, you know, these Jews were kind of a little bit different. They ate differently. They didn't do certain things. They would have stood out. They weren't kind of as assimilated as everyone else. And so you could kind of detect the jealousy, the anger, the racism that was going on there. And so they're just kind of almost seething that these Jews would dare to defy the king. And so they bring these things before the king, and they say in verse 12, "These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Right? This may even go beyond just this ceremony. This may be a statement that they never worship your gods. We're under them. They never go to worship your gods. And now even more so, you set up this image and they don't bow down. They don't participate in the worship of the nation of Babylon. So they bring these things before the king. Now, of course, verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar's furious. His ego has been assaulted. This is his huge ceremony. This is his pride. This is his pomp and circumstance. You can understand how this egotistic king would be a little bit upset that they've ruined his ceremony. Right? The whole point of this is everybody being unified together, submitting, bowing to Nebuchadnezzar the Great. And so he's upset. And they bring these men before the king. But what's interesting, you go, well, why doesn't he just throw them into the fiery furnace? Why does he give them a second chance? Notice what it says here in verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, and bagpipe, every kind of music, fall down and worship I have made, great. But if not, I'll throw you into the fiery furnace." Why does he do that? Why does he give them a second chance? Anyone I throw that in the questions? Yeah. Okay, that could be certainly like, okay, let's see it, we'll witness it, everyone's here. Good. Any other reasons why he might do that? Could be. Could be that. I would suggest this is kind of face saving. Kind of to save face a little bit. Like, the whole idea of this is everyone bowing to his greatness. He wants everyone to bow down. And so you don't want to, like, in one sense, if you kill the rebels, they kind of win. So here, I'll intimidate, I'll show my greatness. If you bow down, who kind of gets the glory? He does. He does. Because, and so we don't know all the reasons why necessarily. It could be a combination of everything that was said, but it seems to me that it's a little bit of saving face here. I want everyone to bow to my greatness. He's this egotistic kind of a guy. And so I not to deny that there may be other aspects, but that seems to me why he gives them a second chance. And he kind of, you see the kind of, and who, which God, the end of verse 15 there, and who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand? It's like, I am the greatest. No one can deliver you from me. There is no God who is greater than I am. And so you kind of see his ego flaring up there. You see, once again, he kind of giving them a chance. It's like they bow down. He's like, yeah, I'm the one. I'm the king. You see his ego. You see his power. But the heart of this whole chapter, of course, is verse 16, 17, and 18. To hear these three men's response. Amazing response. Then just you understand, we paint the picture for what's going on here to understand how these men respond within these three verses. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. What a response. What a response. You know, basically what they're saying, you know what, king? We're guilty as charged. Think about this for a moment. If they had tried to kind of finagle themselves out of the situation, try to explain it away in any way, if they had tried to kind of say, well, you know what, king, there's kind of some circumstances that you don't understand, and let me just kind of explain this, and da-da-da-da-da, they would have taken the focus away from where the focus needed to be. They were guilty as charged. They were not going to worship his image. They were not going to bow down. And so there's no need to respond. There's no need to answer. They're saying, look, we are guilty as charged. We will not bow down. We're not going to kind of make the issue a side issue. We're not going to try to finagle ourselves out of this situation and draw attention away from the fact that this is an issue about the greatness of God. If they would have made it about, well, you know, oh, we didn't hear the music, or this or that, or some other kinds of excuses that they could have made, if they didn't stand up boldly, that's what they're doing here. They're standing up boldly and saying, no, God is the greatest. We will not bow. It reminds me somewhat of Christ, right? He, when accused, he didn't revile back. He didn't defend himself. He didn't take the focus off of what the focus needed to be. And so they say, we have no need to answer you. It's up to God. And so notice there are two responses in verse 17. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. The first response in verse 17, sum it all up, God is able. God is able. God is the King of Kings. He is the God of Gods. He's the one who is greater than anyone. God's able to do whatever he wants. And so they come back to Nebuchadnezzar and say, look, Nebuchadnezzar, you say that no God is able to deliver out of your hand. They say, no, you are wrong. They directly contradict him. Right? They use the same words. He says, who is able to deliver out of my hand? And they say, I'll tell you who. God is able to deliver out of your hand. They use the same terminology and they say, king, you're wrong. That's bold, right? This is Nebuchadnezzar. This is the greatest king on the earth. And they say, no, king, you're wrong. Our God is able. You say there is no one able to deliver out of your hand. We say God is able to deliver out of your hand. Notice the boldness. Notice that they're standing up for God. Notice just the stance that they take. They're willing to put their life on the line for God. We'll talk about this in just a minute. I mean, I just have to pause there for a second. Is our God worthy enough to stand up boldly and to die for? I mean, people all over this world, right, are dying for the name of Christ. They're standing up for Christ. They're boldly declaring his name. They're not just like keeping silent, Right? Maybe it would have been easy for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to kind of bow down and say, well, we don't really believe that, and just kind of excuse it away in their head. But if they would have bowed, even if they weren't kind of worshiping, if they're just kind of going through the motions, and even if they weren't worshiping his gods, they would have drug God's name in the dirt. They would have said, God really isn't as great as he truly is. We need to stand up for God and to boldly declare his name. And so they're willing to put their life on the line to say, our God is worth standing up for. So I say, just people all over the world, China, Middle East, wherever, they're dying for the name of Christ. They're not being silent. In a time when a government may come and say, all you have to do is be quiet and we won't kill you, people stand up and boldly declare the greatness of God. And they die for it. And so I have to start with the question, is our God worth boldly dying for? And I think we could easily answer that from this chapter and saying yes. But then the flip side is, if our God is worth boldly dying for, then why aren't we boldly living for him? Right? If he's worth all standing boldly in the face of Nebuchadnezzar and saying, you're wrong, Nebuchadnezzar. Even if you're going to throw us in the furnace, you're wrong and we will not bow down. We're guilty as charged. Our God is the greatest. You are wrong. You could throw us in the furnace. You could burn us. We will not bow. If they're willing to boldly stand for God, to die for God, how is it that we're so often afraid to be bold when we're living for God? I ask the question to myself, right? But you see the boldness. You see that their lives are on the line and they're still willing to give it all up for God. And yet so often, we're not willing to boldly live for him. It's a challenge to all of our hearts, right? People in this world are dying for Christ, and yet so often we're not being willing to live for him. It's a challenge, right? God, we're thankful for the peace that we have in this country, right? We are so thankful. Paul says in Timothy to pray for peace so that we can have the freedom to proclaim the name of Christ. We have that. We have the peace that Paul was telling people to pray for in the Roman Empire. We have what they didn't have. We have what they were praying for. And yet, sometimes we're not using the opportunities that we have to be bold for the name of Christ. It's a great, great challenge to us. And so you see their trust in God. They believe that God, they have a firm understanding that God's in control of all, and they say, God is able. God is able. They trust in him. But notice verse 18, almost more amazing than verse 17. But if not. Three simple words. But if not. That's an amazing statement that they make. Our God is able to serve us, but even if he doesn't. Right? There's a quote. There's only one thing more rare than faith, and that's submission. Right? Not only did they have the faith to believe that God was able to save them, but they had the submission to recognize that God may not always do what's pleasant for us. God may not always do what we want. God is able to save us. He's able to throw us in the fiery furnace. He's able to deliver. He obviously delivered in such a way. He created this universe. He created every person in it. He's sovereignly in control of everything that happens. He's able to do whatever he wants to do. Right? You may get thrown in prison, you know, for preaching the gospel. God would be able to save you. You may get insulted. God has the power to change people's hearts. God has the power to do whatever he wants to do. But we have to recognize that God doesn't always want to do what we think he wants to do. He doesn't. And so, but if not, we're still not going to worship your image. We're still not going to bow down. It doesn't matter if God saves us or not from this physical fire. God is still worth dying for. It's amazing because I think we tend to kind of minimize the situation of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as if they were supermen. and they had this super faith, and they were superhuman, and they kind of knew ahead of time that God was going to save them out of the fire. I think we tend to think that, well, this was in the time period when God did miracles. And so, you know, it's not like today when we haven't seen all these miracles. They knew God had done all these miracles, and so they just kind of knew that God was going to throw them in the, you know, he was going to throw them in the fire, and God was going to save them. They didn't know that. They said, you know what? Our God may not serve us. We may save us. We may burn alive in that fire. But it doesn't matter. We're still going to trust in Him. God is going to work out His plan for His glory no matter what. And so we need to trust Him. We need to stand up for Him. He's able to save us. But His plan is beyond our comprehension. His plan is always not what seems pleasant for us. And so sometimes His plan even involves His believers dying in the furnace. And so they said, even if not, let it be known, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Amazing statement, right? They trusted the results to God. That's the lesson for us. They knew that they had to do what is right. They knew that they had to stand up boldly for God, and the results, that's God's business. That's God's deal. He's the one that's sovereign. We are going to stand up. We are going to be bold. We are going to declare the greatness of God. And what happens as a result, that's up to God. Right? They entrust the results to Him. And so, you know, God is able to save. Whether He's willing to save or not, that's up to Him. We need to do our part. We need to be bold. We need to stand up for the glory of God. We need to boldly declare Him, whether it's to King Nebuchadnezzar or whether it's to our neighbor. We need to stand up for God, whether it's someone shorter and skinnier than us or someone that's the greatest king on earth. It doesn't matter who it is, where we are, we need to stand up for God and leave the results to Him. It's all about, we know that whatever God does, whether Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have burned alive in the fire, or whether they would have been saved in such a magnificent way, we know whatever the results are, God is working out those results so that He will receive the glory. We trust Him with that. We trust Him with the end results. We know that He's in control of history. He's working it out. It's all working out according to His plan. He's not going to let anyone rob His glory. We'll see this next week in chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar, the proud, egotistic, great king that he was, God said, look, you're taking my glory and I want it back, and I'm going to humble you so that you recognize, so that you know how great I am. We don't have to worry about it. We don't have to worry about this king or this great person or this boss or this person robbing God of His glory. God won't let it happen. God is going to protect His own glory. The only thing that's important for us is to stand up, to stand up for God, to be bold for Him, to trust in Him, and to leave the results to Him. And I think it's so easy for us to take for granted those end results. It's so easy to forget that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were just like we are. Right? They're just people walking with God. They didn't have any supernatural powers. They didn't have any kind of supernatural faith in the sense that they were fundamentally different than we are. They were just men. There are men who walked with God and men who had a firm, firm grasp on the greatness of God, and they trusted in that unquestioningly, just like Daniel. But that's the lesson for us. Are we going to trust God like that? Leave those results to Him and see what He does, whether we get burned alive in the fire or not. Amazing statement. And so, of course, verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed. Okay, he was mad before. Now he's really mad. I mean, you could definitely say he lost his cool. I mean, it's almost like he got red faced. He's just furious. He's just like, ah, I cannot believe that you would defy me like this. I mean, probably their cool headed trust in God probably just infuriated him all the more. Right, the fact that they're not like cowering and shaking, you know, the fact that they're just calm and cool. No, you're wrong, king, and we're not going to bow down to you. They were calm and they were cool, and they weren't afraid of him. And his ego just, that just infuriated his ego all the more. And so he is just furious. And so, of course, he says, heat the fire 7 times hotter. Just crank that baby as hot as it will go and bind them up and throw them all in. And it's the fire so hot that the guys who throw them in, of course, get consumed by the flames and die. And so you get to the end of verse 23 here, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. That's the climax of the story. They fall in, and the question is God going to save them or not? Right? God is able to save them. God is able to save them, but he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to, but we know what happens. He does save them, and he sends his angel. He sends his angel to come, and so Nebuchadnezzar, verse 24, he's just astonished, right? He's astonished because something astonishing has happened. They cast 3 men in, and there's 4 men walking around, not hurt, not burned, and the 4th is like the son of the gods. I mean, I don't know exactly what that means, but it definitely means he has some sort of special appearance of some sort, right? Maybe he's shown, I don't know, that's probably what happened here. And so I would probably say here, maybe this is the pre-incarnate Christ or the angel of Yahweh as he's referred to in the Old Testament. But anyway, God sends his angel to deliver these 3. Amazing. Just God's personal care for these 3 men who trusted in him. He was able to save, and because God cares, he sends his angel, and they're walking around. Just kind of shows his personal care for these 3 servants. And so as it continues on, you know how the story ends. Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace, and he declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. And so they came out of the midst of the fire. I love this. And the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the king's counselor gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power of the bodies over those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Right? You have, here's King Nebuchadnezzar. You could picture it. And if you listen to the list of the people here, the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the counselors, these are kind of like, if you go to the original list, it's the top few. So it kind of had gone from ascending, you know, greatness to lower greatness as you're dealing with the officials. So you could kind of imagine this big assembly that in the middle of it's like this big image, and King Nebuchadnezzar's probably standing right by the image, and then he has his highest ranking officials closer until you get out to like the lower governors farther away. And so as you're next to the fire here, kind of in the front where all the action is, he's assembled all the greatest kind of men of the kingdom who are here to kind of witness these men being thrown into the fire, burned, and kind of in awe of Nebuchadnezzar's greatness. And so they're standing here, kind of set to witness Nebuchadnezzar's greatness, but instead they witness the greatness of God. And this is obviously just an amazing miracle. They're thrown into this fire that kills the people that throw them in, and there is absolutely no effect of the fire upon them. They don't even smell like smoke thrown into this blazingly hot fire. Not a hair gets singed, Not a thread of their clothing gets burned. They're completely and totally protected and saved by God. Just this awesome miracle of God's power. Right? Going back to that statement, God is able. It doesn't matter what circumstance we find ourselves in. It doesn't matter how impossible it looks. It doesn't matter how difficult the situation is and how we feel surrounded and how we feel locked in. It doesn't matter what the situation is. God is able to deliver us out of any situation. He's able to do these kinds of miracles. And so all of them, all these great leaders within the kingdom of Babylon, they witness the greatness of God. And so Nebuchadnezzar himself says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants." Right? He witnessed it. He saw the power of God. And look at even verse 29 at the end. It says, "For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." God is the greatest. There's none other that is greater than he. And so even Nebuchadnezzar himself is forced to recognize this. But notice also what he says about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. says in verse 28, he says he sent his angel and delivered his servants, notice this, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own god. It's kind of amazing. You know, you never know, you know, what your witness and your testimony, your boldness, what fruit or what result it's going to yield later. Right? Nebuchadnezzar saw their trust in God. He witnessed it. And I would suggest to you, as we go to chapter 4, we'll see Nebuchadnezzar get saved, to kind of use our terminology. But it's amazing how he recognizes their faith and their trust in God. It's a reminder to us, right? If we stand up boldly for God, people watch. People notice. See what happened here. Nebuchadnezzar himself noticed it. I'm sure all these people are watching as this is going on. It's a testimony of the greatness of God. It's a testimony of their faith and their trust in God. If we stand up for God, we boldly declare his greatness, people will see. People will notice, wow, they trust in God. And God works powerfully through them. So it's a reminder that as we stand up and we don't compromise, as we stand up for God, the world is watching. People around us will see. And so, of course, Nebuchadnezzar ends by making this decree. Anyone that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. Right? So typical of Nebuchadnezzar's style. You know, it's just like, okay, if you say anything bad about their God, we'll rip you apart. Right? It's just kind of his way of doing things. But you'll notice he does come short. He recognizes the greatness of God. He understands that God alone is able to save like this, but he certainly comes short of any sort of worship of God. Right? You'll notice even with the decree, he says, well, you can't say anything bad about their God. He doesn't command people to worship or worship himself or anything for that nature. So it's interesting that we'll see that through these stories, we'll get to chapter 4, and we'll watch how the terminology and the language about Nebuchadnezzar changes as time after time again, he sees the greatness of God, he sees the testimony of his servants who trust in him, until ultimately God humbles him and is forced, in one sense, to worship and praise God by God's amazing salvation. Simple story, right? It's a child's story. We all know about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the flaming furnace. But it's so easy for us not to take the lesson home and to apply it to our lives. Do we trust God like this? Right? Unflinchingly. Right? Once again, as we saw with Daniel, we'll continue to see that unflinching trust in God. There's no like quivering and shaking and then, oh yeah, I need to trust in God. Their trust in God is so absolute, the response is so immediate. They understand who God is, and they live in light of it all the time, to where they're always boldly declaring the greatness of God, because the greatness of God is constantly in the forefront of their minds. It's no compromise. Complete boldness. Testimony, faith, trust. Right? And they're willing to give up their lives for the glory of God. They're willing to, they would not compromise for them, to, like I said before, for them to bow down, even if they're quote-unquote not worshiping in their hearts, is to say that your God, you know, it's kind of to bow the knee, to give credence, to not stand up for the glory of God, is to drag his name in the dirt. And so I just even think for myself, you know, start to apply this. You know, I remember back in high school, you know, friends would go to a movie that, you know, I shouldn't be going to. And I knew that I shouldn't go to that movie, and so I didn't go to that movie. But then they'll ask, why didn't you go to that movie? Well, I was busy, of course. Right? And I didn't take that opportunity to stand up and say, because it's wrong. You know, I need to stand up, and this is what conviction is. I don't take I'm afraid of some in some way, and I don't stand up boldly and take opportunities to declare the greatness of God. You know, we all do that in our lives, right? We take the easy way out. You know, that's why I said, I don't know what they could have said to the king, but they didn't try to kind of finagle their ways out of it. They took the opportunity to say, no, our God is the greatest. You're wrong, and we're going to stand up. We're not going to compromise. Right? That's not to say that we always have to be, rude with people. We always have to be like in your face. But certainly the aspect of boldness and no compromise, if we understand how great God is, it's going to impact the way we interact with unbelievers. It just absolutely has to. So many times it's because we fear men. So many times it's because, and that's where, you know, even going back to where we started this whole journey with the book of Ephesians, right, where Paul is saying, pray for boldness for me. And I think, Paul, boldness, really? Right? If Paul needs boldness, we all need boldness. We all need boldness. And that boldness can only come because we have a very clear, solid grasp on the greatness of God. We will not be bold. We will not trust in God. We will not stand up for God. We will not fear Him, I mean, and respond in this kind of way unless we do fear Him like they did. Unless they have that ever-present view and understanding of the glory and greatness of God. And so we all need to just kind of be immersed. We need to be just have our minds soaked with the greatness of God so that we will be able to stand up and trust Him like this and then entrust the results to Him. Right? If God saves Nebuchadnezzar through this or not, it's up to God. If God saves them from the fiery furnace or if they get burned alive, it's up to Him. The results are up to God. That's not our job. But our job is to trust in Him unflinchingly, unquestionably, because we understand how great He is. And so we will not compromise. We will not shrink back, but we'll stand up for Him. Awesome story. It's a true story, right? We know that this happened. It's so easy to kind of think of these things as the nice Sunday school lesson, the nice story about the fiery furnace. But like, these were real men. You just try to put yourself in their shoes. Try to imagine the thousands of people and the greatest king on earth and everyone bowing down and you're the ones that are standing, right? Try to picture yourself brought before the king, seeing the fiery furnace off to your left, burning, seeing the guards with the swords or the spears surrounding you and your three men. Put yourself in their shoes, right? They were just men. They were just like we are, but yet God showed His greatness to them and they trusted in Him. And we know that ultimately God saved in a powerful way. He's able to save, but at the same time we recognize we don't make God save us by what we do, right? He's the one that's in control. We have to trust the results to Him, whatever those may be. And we know He will glorify His name. We know He will. We'll see it in chapter 4. We see it throughout the book of Daniel. He is always going to glorify His name. He will not share His glory with another. But the question is, are we going to be ones who declare that glory? Are we going to stand up for Him as well? Great lesson for us. Let me pray, and then we could even just see if there's any time just to reflect on that with questions and comments. Our Father, as we come before You, we focus on the lesson from the book of Daniel. Certainly I'm challenged by these three men. I'm challenged by their clear-headed faith and trust in You. I'm challenged by their boldness that before the greatest king on the earth, they would say, "No, king, You are wrong. Our God is the greatest." Give us that boldness. Give us that faith. Give us that trust. Help us to entrust the results to You. Lord, we know that You are the one that's in control, and You are the one that's going to bring about all the effects for Your own glory. You're working out all of history for that reason. So we thank You and we praise You for that. We just entrust ourselves to You in Christ's name. Amen.